Ready to go?
Blue lights on.
Here we go. We will call to order our meeting today. Thank you, everybody, for being here. This is the House Subcommittee on Higher Ed, and today is March 31st. Tomorrow will be April 1st. So thank you for being here. We've got a couple of bills we're going to try to get some work done on today, and then we've got the last in our series of guests from our university system. We have Mr. Davies, who's president of Eastern Oregon University, and he's going to be sharing a little bit with us about his fine institution of higher education out there in Eastern Oregon. So that's what we have in front of us today. So with that, I'd like to open up a work session on House Bill 2024. We have an amendment, or you'll find an amendment in front of you, committee, and I'll let our fine administrator, Anna, tell us what the intent is behind the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In its current form, House Bill 2024 permits the State Board of Education to adopt a fee schedule related to civil penalties for licensure violations. It allows the Superintendent of Public Instruction to retain reasonable costs related to investigations and assessments of civil penalties against career schools, and it declares an emergency effective on passage. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means and has a fiscal impact statement. The -1 amendment to House Bill 2024 would limit reasonable costs retained by the superintendent to no more than 20%. Currently, all penalties acquired go directly to the general fund, and in this case, 20% would be directed towards the department, and the rest remains with the general fund.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So that's the amendment committee. Is there any discussion about that?
2024.
That was one that I asked for. I just felt it would, the bill, as it was written, said the department could retain reasonable costs. I just wanted to kind of define what reasonable was, and I think the amendment helps to spell that out. So any further comment about that? Questions? Rep. Springer, I'll let you get up to speed with what we're doing. It's just...
We're there, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Perfect.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments to House Bill 2024, dated 3/29/2011.
Okay. Rep. Dembrough moves to adopt the -1 amendments, dated 3/29/11, to House Bill 2024. Is there any discussion? Questions to that? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move that we send House Bill 2024 as amended to the House Committee on Education without recommendation.
Rep. Dembrough has moved House Bill 2024 with the -1 amendments as amended to the House Committee on Education without a recommendation. Is there any discussion about that bill? It'll need a referral down to Ways and Means. So, Sean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with the motion. I'll be voting yes on the motion. My only concern was that in the summary, if you look in the summary of the bill, it does not discuss fees. And in the actual text of the body, it does discuss fees. Okay. And especially if you look at the, let me pull it up here, I think the SMS form, it does discuss fees. So at least for the record, I want people to know that there, and maybe we can change the summary somehow to disclose that there are fees that the superintendent could impose.
Okay.
To clarify the summary is what I'd like to request somebody to do.
Point well taken. I'm sure Anna can correct that. We encountered that just recently.
Yeah.
On a different piece of legislation, just to make sure that the bill itself jives with what the summary says. So it's a very important point.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Actually, this happens a lot, I think. And, you have to remember that the summary, dies with the movement of the bill. It's the actual language of the bill that becomes incorporated into the statute. So that's what we really have to keep an eagle eye on, I think.
Correct. And I guess my only point is, I would like to have that summary because I know a lot of people just read the summary and they don't drill down to the body. And so I understand we need a summary, but it needs to be somewhat precise.
Point well taken. As we have more and more pieces of legislation to try to wrap our minds around, those summaries are important articles for all of us as we try to do the best job we can. So any further discussion? Any objection to the bill as with the amendment? So moved. Okay, I'd like to open now a work
session.
Close the work session on House Bill 2024. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3471, and we have two amendments that have been submitted, and my intent today would be to let's go ahead and get a presentation on the amendments because they arrived in our desk, as it were, a little late in the process. I'd prefer to not work this bill today to give us all plenty of time to digest that, but let's go ahead and just talk about the amendments as they are submitted. And Rep. Dembro, I believe, has some input on that.
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chair. Really, you only need to pay attention to the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 2s subsume the Dash 1s. The Dash 1s missed a couple of things that were supposed to have been in there. And these are all things that I think we talked about last week. So if you'll look at the front page of the Dash 2s, you'll see under 3B, there's where we have included the service hours requirement that we had talked about, the 30 volunteer service hours in the previous academic year for performing community service activities such as mentoring foster youth or assisting in the provision of peer support services according to policies developed by the institution. And just to clarify, the idea is that not every institution is going to create the same kind of mentorship program that these kids can be part of. That'll vary from institution to institution. Our goal is to see a program like this at every institution, but they'll vary. And that's also why the word such as is there, just to give it a little more flexibility. So that's that change. In Section 4, there's the reference to, this is the language, we talked about this conceptually last time as the last dollar, you know, meaning that there will first be funding will come from the Pell Grant or the Opportunity Grant, and we're excluding the Chafee Grant, which is the one that can be used for housing. And then anything that's left will be that's where the waiver would kick in. And then finally, on the back page, we're asking the OSAC to adopt rules just to make sure. You know, our goal here is that. And their goal, too, within OSAC, is that foster kids be covered through the Opportunity Grant. And this is allows them to develop rules to figure out, okay, in a time of tight budgets where there's not going to be money to fund every student, to make sure that former foster youth have priority. I mean, I think that's... that's our intent, and that's their goal, you know, as well. And so this allows them to a little flexibility in how they adopt rules of how much they need to set aside, and for how long, you know, that kind of thing. So that was the goal of that. So those are the changes, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about them.
So, Rep. Dembro, you're saying that basically that the foster children would be able to move ahead of the line, as it were, in regards to eligibility for the Oregon Opportunity Grant?
Correct.
Is that correct?
And, you know, frankly, in part, that's to protect the universities from having to use the waiver more than they you have to.
Sure.
I mean, our goal is, if you'll remember, our goal is to have the state act as the parent for these, you know, children, and to pay the, you know, the parental element of the shared responsibility model. And so this is an effort to make that more likely to happen.
Is there a discussion about the Dash 2s committee comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the explanation. I also want to say I appreciate the handing gross dash, too. That's very helpful in reading it in the totality. Not specifically on the dash twos, but on the bill in whole, are we going to see a fiscal or a revenue on this at some point?
I would assume so. Did we get a fiscal on the dash ones, Anna?
Mr. Chair, the policy is when, and we're submitting an amendment, we place a hold on the previous original version of the bill so that fiscal and revenue aren't working overtime to create a version, a fiscal impact for something that then won't be adopted. And so at this point, I've submitted a fiscal for the dash two. The dash one had not been produced yet because of the short timeline.
Okay. And then my other question is, what will be the subsequent referrals to the bill in the whole if we adopt the dash two? Is it go to subcommittee? Is there a subsequent to the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education? I guess that depends on the fiscal, right?
It depends on the fiscal. And yeah, I have no way of knowing. I would hope not, but I would assume so.
All right.
We have the ability to pass this today, and the you know, as long as the fiscal gets to the full education committee before they act on it, then we're okay. You know, it's a question of whether you all feel comfortable moving this bill onto them, not knowing what the fiscal is, and just leaving that to their discretion.
Yeah. Well, I thank the chairs for the opportunity to not work on it today, so that we can. This is the first time I've seen the dash twos and to be able to digest those. And I'd prefer to see a fiscal as well in the revenue.
Yeah, I would prefer. I wanted us to have a chance to at least work the amendment, if you will, and chew on that a bit. I just saw it when I sat down here today myself, so I just, as chair's prerogative, rather wait until at least our next session to attempt to move this bill if we can. So with that, any other questions about the amendments as submitted and so forth? We'll just go ahead and carry this over then. Close the work session and carry this over to our Tuesday agenda for next week.
Hey, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just recognize we have some former foster youth in the room, and hi.
I remember you
Good
guys.
To see you guys again.
They're back.
If you can come back Tuesday, then hopefully we'll put this to bed. And if not, know that it's in good hands.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay. So we are also going to carry over House Bill 3521 to Tuesday. We're waiting for amendments there that we do not yet have, so we'll carry that over. And I'd like to now open up an informational meeting. We have honored with us to have today again Mr. Bob Davies, who's president from Eastern Oregon University. This is the last in our series of overviews of what's going on at our institutions of higher ed around the state of Oregon. So, Mr. President, feel free to share with us what you've got about your fine institution.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, if you will. And I just want to welcome Mr. Davies here. I know we tried to set up a time, had a time set up, actually, and then the snow rescheduled us here a while back. And unfortunately, I have another commitment today, so I'm not going to be able to stay for your presentation. I'm sorry about that, but I did want to welcome you, and I hope that we can reconnect here in the very near future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rep. Springer.
Before I begin my formal comments, let me share some excellent news about one of our students. Later today, actually in about 25 minutes, in Washington, D.C., in front of the national press, Lonnie Omahora, a junior from EOU from Saipan, will be awarded and honored as a Truman Scholar. She will be one of 60 such Truman Scholars. Over 6,000 students apply for this designation each year. As you may know, the Truman Scholarship is one of the most three coveted academic scholarships. The other two are being the Rhodes and the Marshalls. Rilani is our first Truman Scholar at Eastern, and I say first because it does signify that there will be others.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you for Rilani, and when she talks about the passion that she gets from her professors, it is true that is what is one of the things that elevated her to this significant award. Thank you very much for allowing me the opportunity to briefly discuss Eastern Oregon University, where I've been honored to be the president since July 1 of 2009. EOU is a proud and we embrace our legacy of being a regionally based public university, and we are very proud of our affiliation with the Oregon University system. As a member of the state system of higher education, of public higher education, we fully support Senate Bill 242. To me, it is imperative that we have a strong state system with seven universities operating in the portfolio and the cooperation and the partnerships that they have. Furthermore, as a state university, we do understand that state spending must be reduced and that you as legislators and leaders have very, very difficult decisions that you must be making. We share in that respect. We share in that knowledge that we must also curtail our own spending and change our programs. We have instituted such plans at Eastern Oregon University, and we will continue to implement those plans in the forthcoming years. Having said that, we must also be careful to not go so far below the governor's recommended budget, as in those cuts become even more to the bone. EOU, while among the smallest public universities in the state based on our enrollment and our budget, plays a very critical role in the state public's higher education goals and objectives. We are the only four-year university east of the Cascade Mountain Range, and we focus on serving all of the rural counties of Oregon. Our students choose us because of the role we play within the region and the state. Our students, who typically graduate from rural high schools with very small graduating classes, assist in running the family farm, the family restaurant, and other businesses. They are accustomed to and need that personalized attention and instruction that Eastern Oregon University is able to provide. Our class sizes are very small. They range around 15. That's very important because most of these graduates, or most of our students, come from high schools in which the graduating class could be 6, could be 10, or typically less than 50. Yesterday, in the Oregonian, in a series of stories about rural higher education gap in rural Oregon, the reporter talked a lot about what was going on at Stanfield High School. And in that paper, they talked to a lot of the students who planned to attend Eastern Oregon University, or in one case, Oregon State University. We lost one. And what they talked about is what is being delivered at EOU. Small classes, personalized attention. These students have selected and will continue to select EOU in large part because of our dedication to serving the goals and ambitions of the individual student. We do not treat them as a number, and we don't treat them as just another cog in the wheel. I have been associated with 6 other universities in my career, both as a professional and also as a student. And it's easy to say that we are student-centered. If you Google student-centered universities, you will come up with thousands and thousands of universities. But at Eastern, I can truly acclaim that we live up to that mantra. In our course catalog, the professor who is listed as teaching the class is, in fact, the person teaching the class. We do not have teacher's assistants or grad assistants. When I was in high school, I was always told, when you go to college, sit in the front 2 rows of the classroom to be successful. We only have two rows in our classroom. Earlier today, I was talking with one of our representatives, and they have an intern from Portland State. Her average class, her smallest class, was 90. With one of our students, I asked, what is your largest class? And it was 35. We are a different university. We specifically work with the students. It is not uncommon for our professors to hand out their cell phone numbers and their home phone numbers to all of their students and expect them to call when they have questions. Office hours are non-existent at Eastern because of the accessibility. Our core values are about providing accessible higher education, being affordable, and being engaged in the many communities we serve. By being committed to this tripartite vision, we have seen an incredible resurgence of EOU in the past several years. Because of our dedication to the student, by reaching out and embracing our regional identity, I have been informed by the Chancellor that EOU is in fact the fastest growing university in the state system over the past 5 years. Since 2006, our enrollment has grown 23%, and we have maintained our teacher-to-student ratios and those small class size. We have attained our identity. This growth is fueled by serving more and more Oregonians. And those are growing especially from rural areas. And we do project this trend to grow. Today I'm joined by three such students who have chosen Eastern Oregon University, who represent the students that we serve. I also must point out that they drove here 6 hours to give testimony for 3 minutes and to meet with all of you in 15-minute increments. The first is Logan from Cove. You stand and wave. I love his belt buckle.
All right.
Oh, boy.
Looks like the governor.
Not going to comment on that one. Devin from Union and Tim from Halfway. As I mentioned, each one of these fine young men are missing their classes today, but the president will give them an excuse. Our commitment to rural Oregon students is evidenced by our overwhelming percentages of students who attend Eastern Oregon University from our service area. Nearly 50% of the students who are enrolled in one of the 7 public universities from a rural county is at Eastern. In all of the counties east of the Cascades, 60% of those students have chosen Eastern. In the 12 most eastern counties of this great state, 3 out of 4 students who are enrolled in a public university have selected Eastern. And one statistic that I'm very proud of, that no other university can come close to boasting, in our home county of Union, 80% of the students who have gone on to higher education have chosen our university. That also equates to an amazing business and economic development opportunity for Eastern Oregon University. I've recently been informed that EOU represents 8.4% of the employment base for the county and represents over 10% of the tax base for the county. That's in one business, if you want to call it that. As we look to the next year, we project another double-digit growth percentage in enrollment. As of last Friday, our applications are up by 36.3%, well above the system average of less than 20. In addition, we already have a robust transfer program. Our transfer applications from Oregon community colleges is doubled from last year, and our admitted and accepted transfers from Oregon community colleges is up 168%. But let me be clear that our enrollment growth is not all about recruiting students. That is only the first step. It is also about retaining and graduating and then finding gainful employment and furthering the educational goals of our students. Our freshman and sophomore retention process has recently been nationally acclaimed as a stellar practice and the best practice for other universities to follow in the country. This designation was given to us by the American Association of Colleges and Universities. From 2009 to 2010, over 70% of our freshmen persisted to the sophomore year, over 74% from 2008 to 2009. I'm also extremely pleased to announce that from our fall 2010 freshman class, 93% attended classes in winter term. We lost only 21 students. Being in a small university affords us the opportunity. I was able personally to talk to each of those 21 students. 4 of them left EOU for academic or disciplinary reasons. They didn't want to talk to me too much. 3 transferred to different universities. 2 went to the Idaho system. 1 went to the Washington State system. And the other ones left for financial or other reasons. And many of those, 17, all but 1, plan on returning. It's also about graduation rates. It's also about getting our students jobs. From internal surveys and studies, we know that our graduates are able to secure employment within their field of study within 16 months. In the latest survey, over 85% of our graduates had secured employment in their field of study or where they were in graduate school within 18 months of graduation. In a similar survey for our graduates who will walk across the stage this June, nearly 50% of them either have jobs or have been accepted to graduate school. I am also very, very pleased to announce or to remark that our graduates stay in Oregon. Another individual who traveled with us today graduated from Eastern Oregon University nearly 25 to 30 years ago. He lives in LeGrand. He is involved in the community. He's engaged with the EOU Foundation, and he also spent time driving over today to spend time with you and talk about Eastern Oregon University, and that's Craig Nightingale. Another significant dimension of EOU, and I've talked a lot about our campus, is our distance education and online programs. EOU is a national leader in our ability to offer full degree programs for individuals completely at a distance. We have established 16 sites and centers throughout the entire state, and these sites and centers have staff, have facilities to meet the needs of our students. We have implemented a system that brings higher education, quality higher education, to all parts of our state. And in doing this, unlike many other online programs, there is not a difference between the quality or services offered between our online programs and our on-campus programs. The student is an Eastern Oregon University student, and when they graduate, they have an EOU degree. It is not segmented by where they took it, and therefore it's imperative that they all have the same experiences. We are nationally known for our ability to leverage technology and maintain that key component of personal interaction among our students and our professors. Today, I'm also joined by a 2010 graduate from one of these programs. His name is Gary Wilhines.
Gary?
Now, a little story about Gary. He did, in fact, attend graduation in 2010, and he had received a standing ovation when he received his diploma. He will say that was because of his stellar academic ability, his commitment to students, and his ability to engage everybody. I will tell him that we graduate everybody in alphabetical order, and he was the last one. I am also very pleased to say that Gary is one of those individuals that was able to find a job fairly quickly after graduation. I was worried about him.
He's gamefully.
I wish to conclude with a look to our future. We have all discussed and we all look at the higher education gap in rural areas. We at Eastern Oregon University take this charge very seriously. And we have instituted many programs to address this over the past several years, if not decades, through our distance education programs and others, and we are seeing positive results. But I want to make it clear to all of you that we are not resting. In what may be an unprecedented partnership, we are working with two, officially and formally, two community colleges, two ESDs, nine school districts, eight specific high schools, three elementary schools, and two middle schools in creating what we are calling the Eastern Promise. The Eastern Promise's sole goal is to create a seamless system of education starting in the sixth grade and ending with a bachelor's degree. This promise, created by this unique partnership of four-year schools, two-year schools, ESDs, superintendents, principals, teachers, and everyone in the mix, putting all of our jealousies and turf wars aside, is how do we put the student first? How do we engage the families in the sixth grade to talk about higher education? How do we work with the parents to understand what they need to do financially? How do we work with the students to show that even in the sixth grade, they can walk and be part of a college campus? In their freshman year of high school, working with advisors so that they have a curriculum that is outlined and mapped to success of higher education, to fostering and much more furthering dual credits the junior and senior year. As part of this partnership, we will not only have dual credit opportunities for high school teachers to teach classes that will count towards high school and college, we will put our college professors in the high schools. We will use our technology to offer classes in the high schools. To my knowledge, this has never been done in the United States and not in this state to put these type of work together. This work is about providing access, about being affordable, and about being engaged with our community, which is the hallmark for Eastern Oregon University. I would be more than happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. That's an excellent report. It's great to get insights in what's going on. You know, we've had some excellent examples of some really high marks that were throughout our university system, but each institution obviously is very unique in what they're doing within our education system. If I could get you just to expand on the Eastern Promise a bit that you closed with, what's entailed in that promise to that sixth grader, and what are the expectations, or what are you offering
sure,
to them if, in fact, they do something else or whatever?
Well, ideally, we would like to offer them a scholarship.
Sure.
And that's where we are heading, but that's not where we are at now. What we are working with is to present to the sixth grader and to their families that college is a viable option and what college can bring. Yesterday in the Oregonian, there was a very good article about Eastern and Stanfield, and I was very, very pleased with that. But I was also reading some of the comments from the readers and whatnot. And one stuck out and said that higher education cannot be the end-all be-all. And I agree with that. We must also work with these sixth graders and their families to show what higher education can leverage. The goal would be is that every sixth grader will go and walk on a college campus and meet with a faculty and a student at one of the campuses, that the parents will go through a workshop on financial aid and financial planning for college, and then in the seventh grade to do further that and actually have them attend a class or two on the college campus for the parents, again, to get further information on financial planning and what it would take, to move forward, starting in the eighth grade, working with the counselors and whatnot, planning their high school curriculum out, and then and as soon as they hit their freshman year, they are ready to start studying and understand that they just can't take the basic math class. They have to take more than basic math. So it is a continuum. Ideally, we will be offering them, if they go through this entire process, acceptance into one of the three universities, or the university or two community colleges as part of that. We would like to offer a scholarship inducement and other things along those lines.
Well, I think that's a great idea. I'm glad to see that. You know, we've heard presentations on the Aspire program that works under OSAC, which primarily deals with high school, I believe, at this point in time.
The Aspire program would definitely be part of this. This is working in conjunction with Aspire.
Well, I guess what I like is that you're directly making sure that you get the family unit engaged in this conversation as early as possible, because that makes all the difference in the world to open the parents' eyes to not only what the opportunities are, but the requirements are of them as well, to ensure that their student stays on track and then begin to plan ahead for the financial obligations and needs and all that as well. So I think that's great.
When I was a sixth grader, the debate wasn't if I was going to go to college or not. It was which college I was going to go to. We don't have that same debate with many of the students in Eastern Oregon, and we'd like to create that debate.
Could you expand just a little bit more on putting professors in the classrooms?
Mm-hmm.
How do they engage the classrooms at the high school level, or even farther down if they go farther down below
They will stick within the high school and would it will
actually
will,
offer actually teaching or
yes
or,
no okay. They will be offering, for example, this coming fall at LeGrand High School, we will be offering an English lit class, mm-hmm. and we will be also offering a political science class. We're looking to work with Cove High School in offering a psychology class. These would be the 100-level courses that would not only count for their credits at Eastern Oregon University, but also towards their high school diploma as well. In most cases, when you talk about dual credit, what you're doing is you're asking the high school professor or high school teacher to teach the course, and then the student receives credit both at the high school and at the collegiate level. What we're doing is taking our professors and putting them in the classroom. Again, giving the student the knowledge, the confidence, and the exposure to higher education, and proving that they can be successful.
Mm. I think that's a great idea.
Questions, Sean?
Yeah,
Rep. Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to the committee, 2 weeks ago tomorrow, we were at Eastern Oregon University and for redistricting hearings.
Oh, sure.
And President Davies was a gracious host, and next time you're going on I-84, I'd really encourage you to stop by and spend some time there. It's a gorgeous campus, and
you
do a fine job out there, and I just want to commend you on your job. Also, for Logan, Devin, and Tim, I knew where Union was. We talked about Catherine Creek, and my family spending a lot of time up there. I knew where Cove was. I knew where Nissa was, but I didn't know where Halfway was. And I just found it on Google, so
it exists.
There's a lot of Lindsay ghosts up there at Wallowa Lake, and so we've spent a lot of time there, but we'll have to go to the other side of the mountain to get to know Halfway a little bit.
Absolutely.
And finally, I just want to say, I think the reason why people were clapping was that Gary was coming back to Salem finally, and he was leaving LeGrand.
I will come on that. Let that one slide.
Rep. Denver.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Bob, thanks for that great presentation. And you know, colleagues, you may not know that, you know, Bob has really been instrumental in turning this university around. Mm-hmm. This was a school that was kind of floundering, and it's found its way, and I think you can see it's really moving forward in a very positive way.
I'd like to thank you for those comments, but also very quickly say that this is a team effort.
Yeah.
There, we have an excellent leadership team of vice presidents and deans. Our students are extremely engaged in this process, and our faculty are a group of faculty members that I cannot talk highly enough in their commitment to students. It was their passion that drives my passion.
Thanks for saying that. Yeah, I know many of those faculty, and they're really first-rate people. I have a few questions, and following up on Rick Johnson's question about the Oregon Promise and the relations between the university faculty and the high school faculty, you're doing some interesting things about helping your local high school faculty become accredited or, you know, able to teach the high school classes for university credit. Could you say something about that, Bob?
Right. One of the parts of the Eastern Oregon Promise is not just about the students or the potential students. It's also working with the faculty of the local high schools and offering them opportunities for further training and further ideas and to enhance their own skills and knowledge. Taking English professors and having intensive writing courses, history professors, history teachers, and bringing them to campus and having workshops over the summer, and doing it in a way that is very not cost prohibitive for the teachers and whatnot, and being very aggressive with all of our professors and reaching out and engaging the local teachers. Something very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
You know, I happen to feel that it's those relationships between the university faculty and the high school faculty that really make accelerated learning programs work, and I don't think anybody's doing it better than Eastern.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. We had a very interesting meeting about 2 months ago where we brought in the entire math department from LeGrand High School and Cove and Union and met with our professors in math, and there was always this, you know, they don't get along or whatever. Within 2 minutes, they were talking formulas and everything else, and it really demonstrated how powerful it is by bringing all of these people into one area.
My second question has to do with distance learning. You know, as you mentioned, Eastern is a real leader in the area of distance learning. And, you know, at some point I think I'd like us to have a hearing just on distance learning in higher education and, you know, where it's at and, you know, where it should be going. And I wonder if we could just get your initial sense of that.
I would love to do that, and I think that Eastern and our faculty that are involved in distance learning will definitely open your eyes. Let me provide some very brief comments, and actually today in the Chronicle of Higher Education there was a article about distance education. Distance education is not a silver bullet. Many universities feel that it will be a cash cow and a money maker. If you do distance education correctly, it is not. It is not a cash cow. It is one more modality to offer education. Education is a personal business. It is the connections between the professor and the students, and the students and students among themselves. And whenever you think about distance education and technology and everything else, the key component is how do you use that technology to further the knowledge, to further the communication. Heidi Harris, one of our professors in English, Ellen Martin, one of our professors in psychology, just did an extensive survey of our own students and asked them, what are the things that you need out of distance education, and also through and also compare that to our students on campus. And there were some very interesting findings. The distance education student wants more personal attention than the one on campus. You cannot forget that. So, and people are expensive. Technology is a wonderful thing, but imagine us as a law firm. Westlaw was an amazing attribute to the law firm, but it did not allow a lawyer to go from 100 clients to 200 clients and serve each one effectively and efficiently. It gave them more tools. So the question is, how do you use that electronic tool to further the students that you're serving now and slowly, gradually build that up? And so technology is a implement to be used. It cannot be that silver bullet. That personal attention is absolutely 100% critical. drawing the distinctions, and one of the reasons why we have 16 sites and centers, again, is that personal attention. To my knowledge, we're the only university that has that extensive, across the country, that extensive network to serve our students. Students want to see a person, and that's all very important. Gary went through a distance education program. He walked on our campus twice, once to take an art class and the second time to get a diploma. All the other time he was at Chemeketa Community College. Do you want to make any comments about your experience in distance education?
Well, I could.
As long as you're here, though, I would love to.
I won't pay him, I'll tell you that much.
Please. And I'm assuming you were a poli-sci major, is that correct?
He wrote his dissertation or his commitment on the kicker for foreign policy. Let's put it there.
That's true. The Gary Wilhelms, for the record, the degree was philosophy, politics, and economics, which I think is a degree that's only offered at Eastern Oregon University. And it was primarily online. I did take most of my undergraduate work at Portland Community College, either Sylvania or the Rock Creek campus, and most of the upper division stuff, except for humanities camp one summer up on EOU, was done online or at a weekend class at the Portland Center out in Clackamas County. So it was and I started out, I had about a year that I'd amassed over my lifetime, and so I got probably 3 years of higher ed in a four-year period of time, going around all year round.
And you were able to count those credits, Gary?
Yes, the credits that I had achieved. And then I was able to, I have to tell you that the service that EOU provided through their Portland Center was wonderful, too, because I didn't know exactly what I was getting into when I went in there, but I said, I want to know all of the ways that I can get college credit, all of them, because I'm going to get them every way I can. So they started out, they laid out a program for me, and with the graduation in June of 2010 as the objective, and I was able then to go back and apply for military service credits, for training I'd received in the military, for credits for certain, the title fails me now. Yeah, well, APEL, yes, APEL essays, and then also I challenged a couple of courses, but I was thinking of the training that I'd received on the job with my former employer. There's a name for that, but you have to file for it, and you have to write, usually essays for it, and they have to be reviewed by people on the campus, and then you can get a certain amount of credit that way. You can't get it all that way, but you can get some that way. But most of the credit was gotten, as I said, either in the classroom or online. And the online, my experience online was wonderful. The instructors are just as the president has said. The instructors were available by telephone if I wanted to call, whenever I wanted to call, I'd call them, and sometimes I wasn't a happy camper, and they would engage, and it was fun, it was good, it was a great experience that way, but they were available. I would prefer to take my classes in the classroom any day over online. They're not easy, and it's the trouble with online learning is that it's impersonal. It's kind of dress right dress. This is what you've got to do, and here's how you got to do it, and you better do it that way, and then you go take a proctored exam, and so there's not a lot of latitude. There's not a lot of engagement with an instructor, and you don't get to ask a lot of questions unless you pick up the phone and call them. And so it's got ups and downs, but it's a great program, and I have to put in this little plug. When I served in the legislature back in the 70s, it was one of my frustrations that at that time I was trying to get some higher education because I didn't have a degree and I thought I ought to get one. And it was very difficult when you were working full-time or serving in the legislature and raising a family. And back then, there were no cell phones. There were no computers. Yeah. The way you got your higher education, if you didn't go on campus in the classroom, was to do those crazy correspondence courses, or go to night school. And if you lived in places like Klamath Falls, you did have an option to go to some night school because OIT was there. But in a lot of these little towns out in Eastern Oregon, you had no choice. You had to take those crazy correspondence courses. Well, it took forever, and it was clumsy, and it wasn't what I would call first-class education. So I started complaining about it, and pretty quick, Eastern Oregon University stepped up, and it was good. They did a good job, and over my years between the 1970s and 2010. I had some interaction with Eastern Oregon University a couple, three times, and they were always responsive. They were always kind of a leader in trying to accommodate the non-traditional student, and some of which was, of course, online. But now, most all the schools do it, private and public. It's not any new news. But back in the 70s and the 80s, it was EOU that stepped up in the state of Oregon.
So, Gary, we found that your newly acquired degree helped you in terms of negotiating a favorable settlement here in your current employment situation?
I am now an intellectual giant, and I'm able to stand in there with anybody.
In his own field.
No, it's been a great experience, and I love it. We've had a lot of fun with it. Of course, my kids all graduated from college before I did. I was the brunt of a lot of jokes. And still am.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
Can I follow up one last question, actually? And this is related to the distance learning, and that's it. Next week we're going to have a hearing where we want to follow up on a study that was done on rural access in general. That there was a, you know, as I think you were probably part of it, Bob, a task force was set up to look at rural access in Oregon, done through the Joint Boards of Education, I think, and a report was issued. And you know, it sounds like the Oregon Promise is very much a part of that, and distance, your use of distance learning, very much part of that. But since we have you here, what are a couple of other things that you would throw out there as, you know, if you're really going to fulfill a commitment to extending access to higher education to all Oregonians everywhere in the state, what should we be thinking about?
I think that the expansion of distance education, the expansion of the sites and centers is a paramount to that. We need to continue to invest in those sites and centers. The connection with community colleges. Many of our sites and centers are on community colleges. Yesterday I visited our Mount Hood Community College site. Nearly 220, 230 students have gone directly from Mount Hood Community College directly into either one of our business programs, education programs. We've just started an MBA program. So those strong connections between the four-year institutions and the two-year institutions is critical. There are areas that cannot be served in that manner. We have a site in Burns that is in a mobile home in the parking lot of the high school. Being that creative and that ambitious to be where those students are is something that we need to continue to move forward on. We also need to be continuing thinking about the affordability mix. These are difficult financial times. There is no question about it. Higher education has a fixed cost, and it is not the cheapest in the world. And as we disinvest from one area, tuition will be picking up the other side of that, and so that is something that we must be very, very cognizant and careful of. One of the things that we are doing, this form will be outdated in 2 months. On the back it says no out-of-state tuition. That has been a policy of Eastern Oregon University for 30 years. We will begin charging out-of-state tuition. That is in a direct response to the financial conditions that we find ourselves in. In doing so, we will recruit more and more students from out of the state. And that is how we must operate to keep tuition affordable for our in-state students. We will not, I want to be very clear, we will not lose our mission of serving more and more and more Oregonians. My goal is that right now we're at 4,227 students. 1,933 of them on our campus. My goal is to get that number up to about 6,000, and my goal is to keep that ratio about the same with out-of-state and in-state students. So we will continue to serve more and more Oregonians, but to do that, we will have to change our fee structures.
Thank you so much for being here, both of you. I mean, it's just really nice to hear about what's happening in different parts of the state with different universities. I'm really proud of our university system and what we're able to offer. And believe in small schools, went to one, and in regional education. It's very important. When we spoke last, you talked about the change from having no out-of-state tuition to having out-of-state you know, having a differential tuition model. But I think you spoke about possibly making a differentiation for some students, perhaps from Idaho or from areas where it really is within your area of influence. So
right.
Can you talk a little, or
sure.
region, yeah.
What we are actually will have a tripartite tuition model by the end of 2012. We will have I call it in-state, but it's more in-region. We receive a significant portion of our students from Idaho and Washington. The difference, I probably shouldn't say these in the hallowed halls of politics, but the difference really is a river. And we receive a significant portion of our students from Idaho and Washington that come to us because of the services that we are able to offer. In offering, if we started offering or start implementing an out-of-state tuition for those students, we would lose them. We must maintain a critical mass.
Okay.
In addition, politically, marketing, competitive nature, Washington State and the Idaho schools do not charge Oregon students in this area out-of-state tuition. So we are in a finale fight with them, and so we must continue that effort. And so that in-region area would hold Idaho and Washington exempt. But we will start what we call a 2X model for all the other states. 2X meaning two times the in-state rate. We will also be instituting a 3X, or a three times rate, for international students. Right now we have 42 international students on our campus. We're working directly with Western Oregon University to expand that with very, very specific target areas. We will be bringing in a different type of student. This will change, in some respects, the look and feel of Eastern Oregon University. We will maintain our commitment to students. We will maintain our closeness. We will maintain the size of classrooms, but it will be a slightly different mix. And that's changing, and I'm not complaining. That's just in the changing environment that we find ourselves in. To remain viable, to remain financially viable, we must do that. Every public university system is going through hardships. My alma mater is the University of Nevada, Reno. $47 million cut they just received that must be implemented by July 1. This is on top of millions and millions of dollars that they received last year. They have received about 40% of their budget cut within the last 2 to 3 years. Most recently, I was at the Pennsylvania State System, 53% budget cut. Now, I'm not telling you these numbers to give you ideas, please. Got to put that out there, too. But every university is handling this differently. Yesterday, there was a survey that was put out. Those universities that have 25% or more out-of-state students paying out-of-state tuition are ferreting this budget wave okay. Those between 10 and 25% are hurting, but not dramatically. Those that have 10% or less are the ones that are significantly changing. And so our ratio is very low. 45% of our revenues come from the state. And so the state budget cuts that you're talking about, and again, I'm not complaining, just stating, impact Eastern Oregon University more severely than at the other universities. The other universities have a lot less of the state appropriations for the revenues. We are playing catch-up. The out-of-state tuition model was put into place to help protect Eastern Oregon University 30 years ago, and it has. It has been a great thing for us. But now we're in a different environment, and we must change the way that we operate. And we are.
Just a follow-up. I really appreciate that, given how difficult the financial times are and the situation you're in, that you were able to step back and take a regional approach, because the commonality that we have for kids coming out of rural areas, for them to have access to this kind of education model, and for us to be able to maintain those agreements with Washington and Idaho schools, it just makes it so there's more opportunity for kids. So I just appreciate the thought that you put into it.
Thank you very much. And we keep them. We keep those students come to LeGrand, or they come to to our Treasure Valley Community College campus site. They stay in Oregon.
Well, why wouldn't they?
I agree. I'm so glad to be back. It's fantastic. Yes, sir.
Mr. Davies, you've in talking about your out-of-state tuition, your lack of thus far, it's my understanding that in addition to not charging that to, you know, Idaho kids, Washington kids, Montana kids, you have also been extending that benefit to undocumented kids as well. Is that right?
We treat each student the same.
Okay.
And so by de facto, it has not been a strategy. It has been de facto
okay.
what has occurred.
Will that change with this new policy here to increase this for to some degree for students that live out of state?
We support the tuition equity policies. And so we hope that that goes through and that would enable us to do that.
If it doesn't go through, would you, have you...
I will talk with the chancellor and see what we can do.
At that point in time, okay.
To me, it's very important. I was talking with Craig Nightingale, our alumnus, about this very issue. And I think I was talking with Gary as well. Educationally, policy speaking, this is a very, very wise thing to do. Financially, politically, immigration, everything else, that's a whole different discussion. As an educational leader, it is something that I support very, very much.
Would you advocate for other institutions to follow in your footsteps?
Is the chancellor here?
Nobody here that knows him is here either.
Let me take it a different way. I know that I cannot speak for the other institutions. To me, as an educational policy, I've had discussions with the other educational leaders within the state system, and I know that all of them have signed letters, all but one have signed letters, and are very much in support of the tuition equity policy. And so not speaking on behalf of them or for them, I just know our conversations that they do agree with the tuition equity policy and would want to move in that direction.
Okay. One other question about enrollment. You mentioned it was up about 23%, I think you said, since 2006 mm-hmm. and so forth. And you've been able to have these small class sizes, which are great. How are you equipped in the area, from the area of bricks and mortar, if you will, to actually have the physical capacity to absorb greater enrollment, but yet be able to keep these class sizes still at an area that you think are necessary and good for your institution?
Well, first of all, we're blessed, physical speaking, that we only have one classroom that could hold 103 students.
Okay.
And so even if we had to hold a bunch of classes with 100 students, we couldn't do it.
The classrooms are like our office sizes probably, right?
Yeah. Pretty close. Well, you have a pretty big office, I should say that.
He's got the degree now. He gets
it. So we're going to be going to him for some big money for the Wilhelm New Education Facility. On campus, I believe that we could, right now we're at 1,933 students. Without an in-depth study, I believe that we can probably go to about 2,300 on-campus students without dramatically changing our physical infrastructure. That is also housing, that is also the facilities for student life, and et cetera. So I think we can get to that level. Also, just very importantly, that would also keep the good balance of town-gown relationships.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't have to have a major infrastructure change for LeGrand in of itself. We, even with our on-campus classes, we leverage technology extremely well. Most of our classes are what we call hybrid. They're both using the technology as well as seated time. Very rarely do we have classes that are just inside the classroom. There's a lot of technology that's being adapted in that. And so one of our barriers is how we can continue to utilize technology. It is something that we're expanding on and continue to grow on. But we can get to about 2,300.
Okay.
Will that force us to be thinking about some things differently? Absolutely. We don't have a lot of classes after 5 o'clock right now. Don't have a lot of classes after 3 o'clock, to be honest. So start extending the class time. Our summer enrollment is not very high. Again, that's another area we can go and expand out. So that would require us to do some changes, but not physical in nature.
Very good.
Yep, follow up.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the distance learning conversation. I was really struck as you were talking and thinking about the mix of distance learning and satellite campuses or satellite centers that you have, that, you know, in some ways the Eastern's competitor is the University of Phoenix. And I'm, you know, just because you're taking a lot of people, I mean, often the University of Phoenix will take people who have associate's degrees mm-hmm. and then, you know, get them to the bachelor's degree level. And I'm just wondering how, if you think about that and if, how you see yourselves stacking up against them?
Sure, we view a lot of different universities as competitors and a lot of different opportunities. So I don't want to discount that, but we offer a very, very different product than the University of Phoenix. The University of Phoenix does some very things that are very well. We in higher education can learn from them. Where we significantly differentiate ourselves is that personal attention. Where we differentiate ourselves is in the ability to work with the individual students in a mentorship way with an individual who will be there for a very, very long period of time. Gary worked with Sue Dobson. And out of the Clackamas County, Clackamas Community College area. Sue works with about 110 different students at different levels, and she knows each of those individuals very, very well and works with them on very, very specific purposes. The University of Phoenix, while having some of that, does not match that personalized attention. The University of Phoenix cannot, while they can match us with some of the technology and whatnot, they cannot match us with the people, the commitment to the people, the faculty members growing back and forth. Gary mentioned having some robust discussions, I'm sure it was with Jeff Dentz.
Jeff was part of that.
But having that, knowing that, as a university president, that a student probably had an intense debate with a single professor. To be honest, I don't know if many of my colleagues can have that type of knowledge and intimate knowledge with their students. That is what the Eastern Oregon University brings to the table. Is it, the next question is it replicable? Is it something that can grow and expand? I think it can. A lot of people would view technology as a way to expand higher education in infinitum. Why not have a class of 150 students on an online class? You're not limited by anything. You're limited by the personal attention. You're limited by the ability of the faculty member to know those students individually and know where they stand, what they're learning and what they're not learning, and where they need to be worked. The University of Phoenix model is built on having that class of 100. And that's where we significantly alter them.
It seems to me that, and I'm sure all the schools are looking at this the same, because a student is a student and you want to recruit, but it seems to me that you've got two things happening in society right now that really enhance the market for online education, one of which is veterans returning from the war.
Mm-hmm.
Another is the fact that the baby boomers are retiring. And there's a lot of people that work through their working life that have got some college but don't have a degree that work kind of like me, and that might, just for their own personal satisfaction, would like to get a degree, or they may want to enter a second career later in their life and could use the education. And this is a perfect way, I mean, it's a perfect way for people like that to complete their education. And EOU, and I'm sure that a lot of the schools can provide that service, and probably just as well as EOU, but my experience was that it was extraordinarily personal if I wanted to make it personal. I could make it as personal as I wanted to make it, and I did in some cases, and it was very good. And like I say, in some cases it was fun, some cases maybe not so much fun, but it was. And the center, and the one that I worked with, as the president pointed out, was over with Sue Dobson in over by Clackamas Town Center is where it is. I don't know what the name of the center is, but in any event, there are others scattered around the state like that. But she was available, and I actually referred a couple of people to her because of my experience, who ended up going to her, and she ended up being their counselor as well, and they ended up going on to Eastern Oregon University to get a degree. So it really is a good way to deliver the service to that market of people that can use it, can make use of it. It really is. I'm high on it. I think it's a great experience. More people ought to do it.
I would agree with most things that he said, but disagree with one of the things that he said. He said that most universities could do it as well as we can. No, they can't. We're much better.
Well, I won't argue.
One of the things, too, when you think about distance education and use of technology, many individuals will jump to the conclusion that that market is your typical 18 to 19 to 21, 23-year-old student. That is not the case.
Right.
Our studies show, and Heidi Harris, again, and I think Heidi, as you mentioned, that you would like to have someone come and talk about higher distance education, Heidi and Elwin would be absolutely dynamite to do that, and I'd be more than happy to set that up, because they know this backwards and forwards. That is not the market. The market are the individuals who are 40, 45, 50, have families, have jobs, and this is something that they're doing to fill something else out. It is not your typical college person, especially your freshman going through. Most of our freshmen, and I mentioned that our enrollments applications are up 36%. out of those numbers, and just roughly speaking, that's 560 plus freshmen who have been admitted. Only about 10 are online. Wow. All the rest are for the LeGrand campus. And that's something, I mean, the online programs, the distance programs, are typically for individuals who are going to complete something, they're bringing something else in. And so the whole different market that we're dealing with.
Representative Harker, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, a few, if I may. The first one is just follow-up to something you just said. 36% increase, I'm flipping through all of these tables and various things online here. 36% increase that I see from 6 to 10 is in distance education. Is that just a coincidence, and there's another 36% elsewhere?
The 36% I was referring to is not located in the instruction tables. It is the admission report that I receive on every Monday.
Okay, very good. Thanks.
So that just happens to be a coincidence.
All right, good enough. So thanks again for all of this information, and much of it we talked about before, and I'm really impressed with a bunch of things you're doing. One statement jumps out at me from the multicolored pamphlet that you brought along, which is it's a private college experience without the high price tag, and in some ways it certainly sounds like that. You guys have the opportunities to have really small classes, which is great. We have it across the street. We don't have it at many of the other OUS campuses. Is the average of 15, that's the number of kids in the classes, or is that the number of people enrolled in the classes online and in the classrooms?
The 15 number is a conglomeration of all of our classroom settings. The online programs typically have around 20. The on-campus typically have around 12 to 15.
But in a classroom setting, the average of the classroom settings is 15. Okay, very good. Thanks.
I'll let the experts answer that question.
All right, good. It must be nice. A question that may be for you, may be for others up here, is how does the level of state funding that travels to a university differ between people in the bricks and mortar classrooms and those online?
It does not differ.
Same amount?
Same amount.
Okay, and if I remember correctly, you told me that the tuition is the same for online, currently, for online and in classroom?
Online is actually a little bit higher. Not much, though, relatively speaking.
Okay, so how could we achieve something closer to this at some of our other institutions, some of these lower, close, small class sizes? How do you deal with the tension surrounding increasing enrollment, trying to keep class size small, and revenues?
That's the magic question that we're all dealing with. I do not believe you can answer that question systemically. Portland State is very different than Eastern Oregon University.
Just think about how. Tell me about how you do it.
How I do it. What we work very closely with is our professors and have them engaged. Last year, we've hired 12 new professors. The way that we're moving forward with the current financial situation is looking very closely where our student demand is, where the community demand is, and applying those resources there. What that means is that some majors and some areas may lose professors, where other ones may gain. This is a very, very difficult and balancing act. Some universities, we are not going to do this. Some universities will start charging differential tuitions within the university based on business or whatever the case may be. We cannot match that. That isn't part of our ethos. What we're trying to do is have an affordable education. One of the things that we must do is diversify our revenue streams. That is where the out-of-state tuition model comes in. Tim Seidel, my vice president for advancement, who's behind me, has a very, very big price tag on the number of dollars he must raise from private support. I'm glad he's sitting next to Craig Nightingale, a member of the foundation board, and we'll get this graduate also part of that process. And so it is managing some of those resources very differently. One of the things that is interesting within the state system is that the board level talks about the portfolio of the state system, and each university has a very different mix and different match. And that also needs to come into play.
Could I just jump in and, you know, to help answer that? You know, one of the big differences between Eastern and some of the larger schools is the teaching loads are different. And, you know, where at the research universities there might be, you know, a greater expectation of research, and so the teaching loads are less. You know, the faculty at Eastern, I know, are very, you know, if I can use the word productive, you know,
absolutely,
in terms of their teaching.
They work harder.
They work in a different way, let's put it that way.
It's that rural spirit.
Absolutely.
Blue collar, get her done.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Our teaching loads are very different. I interview every single faculty candidate, which could not be replicated at the Portland State, just couldn't happen, for example. And one of the reasons I do that is to impart on them that this is a very small community, and I also impart on them, if you're coming here to be a research professor, don't come here. You will teach a lot, you will be engaged with your students, you will give them your cell phone number, and you will be accessible to them. That is our ethos. It's very different than at other universities. And Representative Dimbo is correct that our teaching load, the actual teaching part versus the scholarship part, is different. We're going through the tenure review process right now, and those professors that are excellent teachers, first and foremost, are going through the tenure review process very quickly. Those that are not excellent teachers, they call me a lot, and they're politicking me. But we are fundamentally an undergraduate teaching university committed to students. Representative Dembro and Representative Johnson mentioned that 2, 3, 4 years ago, the newspaper articles about Eastern weren't so positive. And I think a lot of reason for that is that the leadership did not embrace, we are a regional university that is committed to undergraduate education and to serving these students who have fantastic belt buckles. That's what we do. And once we have grabbed that as a university, as a culture, that's what we're all about. And that's, to be honest, that's part of the fun.
Do you have multiple sessions of courses, each of which has more than one small class size?
We do have multiple sessions. For example,
class.
English 101 with 15 students. Yes, we do. We do not have multiple sessions of English 101s. Actually, just yesterday I sent an email to 6 faculty members who had the same class in different sessions with very small classes. And when I say very small, we're talking about 6 or 7, that choose one of the times and combine them. We do that. And I will say that that may not have happened in previous years, but that is something we have to do. Are we going to combine 2 classes of 25 to create one of 50? Probably not. Mm-hmm. Tim graduated, how large are you graduating class? 14? 14. So put
in
him
in high school?
In his high school.
Yeah.
He was in the top 14. Good job.
Yeah.
And so creating those large classrooms would yesterday in the Oregonian, there was a student at the very end said they went to Oregon State. Well, I guarantee he will go to Oregon State, and most likely he'll be back on our campus within a year because of the small class sizes. That is something that is part of our ethos. And creates different cost structures. Make that very clear. We different cost structures. And so that's at the heart of your question, is how do we do these differently? The question becomes higher education throughout the entire state, because higher education is that equalizing, social mobilizing factor that has so many different positive community contributions about it. How are we going to invest to ensure that higher education is throughout the entire state? And what level of cost and how do we make that happen is the critical question. And that's one that I know you're all wrestling with, and that's one that I lose sleep over.
And something that you know I care a great deal about.
Absolutely.
And I'm also wrestling with
how do we
very,
fund it?
With the very different cost structures that we
yep.
have at the very different institutions.
Each,
we provide the same amount of revenue to each of those things in a very egalitarian way.
Yep. And that is the multi-million-dollar literally question.
Literally.
Another thing that hasn't been talked about here, which is, it was an interesting revelation to me when I was going through the graduation ceremony. I noticed that there were people that were also graduating with OSU degrees and OHSU degrees, walking through the same group that I was, and I wasn't that much aware of the cooperative programs that do exist between a lot of the other institutions and EOU, and I'm sure it goes on between all of our OUS institutions, but it was an indication of progress, and it's a good thing.
And those partnerships are very, very important.
Yeah.
Logan would classify himself as an EOU student, but he's technically an Oregon State student. He's in the agricultural department. And Representative Harker, you are raising some the appropriate questions. There is no question about it. We realize the issues that you're facing. We realize that the business model of Eastern Oregon University, we realize the business model of the state system fundamentally has to change. We are embracing that in many different ways. We, as I said before, right now 45% of our revenues come from the state coffers, and we're very appreciative of that. For us to continue to be viable and sustainable, we must lower that, not by budget cuts, but by increasing other revenue streams to probably 30 to 25%. We in many ways are fortunate that we have not had out-of-state tuition. That is an arrow that we can put into our quiver to make that occur. We have other opportunities through distance education to expand and to move forward that we can do. The partnerships are ideal with Oregon State and OHSU, but also how do we develop some of those partnerships to further the opportunities in Hermiston, where right now we are the only university in there, in that the Hermiston Center, working with Blue Mountain Community College to offer other degrees, could be under the Oregon State auspices, but through the EOU connection and creating those opportunities. I also dare say that we can expand into other states, as long as the federal laws don't change as they may have, which creates other issues. So there are plenty of opportunities for us to go forward. We are a state university. We will always be a state university. We will always need the state support financially. Can we become more entrepreneurial? Absolutely. And I think this past 6 months have seen, we've always been entrepreneurial. We started the business education program 30 years ago. We did biology classes where we had to send out cats that were euthanized to the various students throughout the entire state. That was a fun postage bill. We are now able to do that online, and we will continue to do that. We are ahead in the curve in many, many ways, and we will continue to do that. We are a flexible university in that sense.
I appreciate your comments earlier about certain students and where they come from are likely to be more successful in an institution that might mirror what they're used to in their homes or in their communities, if you will. And we've seen that, or at least something similar to that, in my own home district in Hood River, where we had high school students at Cascade Locks High School. It's a very, very small high school, mm-hmm. which would have graduating classes of, let's say, 25 and under. And many of those students that would go off to higher ed would have all kinds of scholarship help, all kinds of, you know, things given to them to help them to the next level. They'd go off for a semester or two and they'd be back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a lot of the issues for them have been traditionally that just life outside of that small community, it's going from a class size of, you know, less than 20 or so to suddenly being put into an institution where you've got multiple, perhaps hundreds in classes, hard for those kids to adapt. So I guess as we think about our state and the diversity of our state, you know, it's important that we have higher ed experiences that can, to some degree, replicate where these students come from. So at the same point in time they're getting their education, they can also be in an environment that's comfortable for them, too. And
absolutely.
And they can achieve as they're able to in that environment, because all kids are not alike, obviously.
No, they're not.
And it's not a slam on them, but
it's
just the reality. You know, the environmental influences that make them who they are important.
The three students behind me are absolutely phenomenal students,
yeah.
And they are very, very successful at Eastern Oregon University. If they went to Portland State, they may not be. They're very, very bright. They will have enormous futures ahead of them. There's no question about that. But if they went to a Portland State environment, they may not be successful. Conversely, someone who was very, very successful at Portland State coming to LeGrand, may, him or herself, may not be as successful either due to that environment. So it's very important that we offer those different elements. But also, let me be very clear that we expose our students to many, many opportunities. 2 years ago, we took a group of students from Burns High School who have never been on an airplane to Beijing. Every year, we have art appreciation class 114, fall and spring terms. About 50 students, two different classes, get together, they jump on a bus, they come to Portland and go to the museums. Out of those 50 students, probably 40 of them will be the first time they ever walk in to a museum. They will stay at a hotel. Two or three of them will get on the elevator many, many times because it's the first time they've seen an elevator.
Portlandia is a world apart.
But we make sure that our students, even though they're coming from these rural areas, are exposed to many, many diverse opportunities. We have just sent three students to China on an exchange program. We sent one student, God willing, to Japan. And he's doing relief work right now in this tsunami area. That student is from John Day. He has never been on an airplane. We have a student today that has never been to Salem. Those are the experiences that we thrive on. So just because we talk about the small classrooms and everything else, we think pretty darn large. Milani winning a Truman Scholarship. Absolutely phenomenal. She spent her internship, she's had two internships, one in Washington, D.C., dealing with women and sex trafficking. Coming from LeGrand. We sent another student to the United Nations where she was the only undergraduate student. Every other student at the United Nations were in master's degrees of public administration or law school, and she was selected at an undergraduate program, and she was nominated as the outstanding student for the United Nations coming out of Eastern Oregon University. She hails from the great city of Crane. And my last story is a year ago, I met a young lady from Oregon High School, and she said, "Bob, I'm so impressed with what's going on here at Eastern. I want to go back to my high school and get every single graduate from my high school to come to Eastern Oregon University." And all six enrolled last fall. We were successful. That's the story of Eastern Oregon University. I've taken a lot of your time, more so than any other president. And you told me, Representative Johnson,
that's okay.
I had all the
time. It's light duty day.
You give a president.
You guys drove farther than anybody else, too, I think.
Yeah.
Too, so.
Chair, can I just ask one last question? I'm sorry. Actually, I have several I want to ask, but I'm just going to focus on one since we have you here. And as you know, we're wrestling with the whole restructuring, the Senate Bill 242 and everything. From the perspective of a small regional university, can you say something about the advantages of being part of a system? Right? I mean, that's something we're going to be wrestling with.
I cannot say this clearer. It is essential that we have a strong state system, a strong state system of public higher education that works together with all seven universities offering that portfolio approach. Eastern Oregon University, if it was not for the state system, I dare say that we would be very hard-pressed to be surviving. The state system offers us many, many, many advantages, and we must, and I am a strong advocate of always maintaining a strong state system of higher education, especially for Eastern Oregon University. It creates the balance of power, if you want to call it that, for all seven universities to fulfill their mission. We are very different universities, all seven of us. Sometimes we're separated by regional or big or small or this, that, and the other. Even with the regionals, Southern Oregon University and Eastern Oregon University and Western Oregon are very, very, very different, and OIT as well. Having that strong state system of higher education ensures, at least puts the ability to ensure that public higher education throughout the entire state is possible. Senate Bill 242 is, in my mind, in many ways, accomplishes that. Will Eastern Oregon University benefit directly from some of these actions in Senate Bill 242? No. But what it does is it continues to have a strong state system, and that's where we benefit. The idea of the institutional specific boards, I'm not opposed to that. I think it's important that if that goes through, that it's It's equal for all institutions. All of them have them, or none of them have them. And if all of them have them, the State Board of Higher Education is the leader. The institutional-specific boards work together among the seven universities and their boards to support the goals of the overall State System of Higher Education Board. The communication is essential. The cooperation is absolutely essential. Once we start having a differential of boards this going off in different tangents, that's when we lose the power of a state system. So to me, it's extremely important to maintain that.
I appreciate that. As you know, this is going to be an ongoing conversation.
Oh, sure.
And,
hey, it's fun.
Yeah, and I look forward to your participation.
Thank you.
Mayor Parker, you got a quick one?
Real quick one.
Thanks.
I think.
You may have a quick question, but I know.
And if it's too complex or you don't want to deal with it now, I'm fine with a follow-up later offline.
Sure.
How are you in terms of your deferred maintenance budget?
Like any public university, not where we should be. Where we're starting to see that is, well, let me answer that in two ways. Because we talked about distance education, and I want to bring that back to that. There are some significant areas that we need to be much more diligent on deferred maintenance. That is an issue for us. It's at a point where it does not keep me up at night, but I could see in about 3 years where it will be, with the exception of Quinn Coliseum, which is part of the capital plan and needs a great deal of tender loving care. But it is not. It's not totally out of line where I've seen some others. I've seen other universities, but it is something that in 3 years that will be a problem. So we, you know, pay me now or pay me later. Also, with regards to that, I've had a very interesting epiphany about deferred maintenance and capital projects and planning and those type of things. And I'll leave this quick statement for a much longer answer. When do we start really thinking about distance education and technology and put that as a capital expense and not just an expense? Because when we start really thinking about where we're going with higher education, and I'm not talking about just distance online and all that kind of stuff, I'm talking about just education as a whole, when does technology become one of those capital assets versus just something we do?
Great.
Good answer. Good point.
Again, thank you very much for your time and attention. It's been a fantastic discussion. Next time I'm asked to come testify in front of your group, I'll make sure that the snow occurs again so I get to be the last to have this much time and attention with you. I sincerely, sincerely appreciate it. And I know that we're all in very interesting times. We, from Eastern, we are taking this on with great vigor. We are not complaining. We know what we have to do, and we will be doing it. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for being here.
And Gary, thank you for your input as well. And guys, thanks for making a long drive. And hope he buys you something on the way home.
Budgets are tight.
Come on. With that, we will go ahead and close our informational meeting and an overview of our Oregon University system. And we will be adjourned until Tuesday.
One more time.